Thanks for coming out. I met Jay over the phone a few months back when I heard that Charles Bohr had passed away, and I called him. As many people here in this room know, Charles Bohr was Charles Olson's literary executor and longtime professor of English at the University of Connecticut at Storrs. And it was Bohr who invited Olson to Connecticut in the last months of his life to teach at UConn. And he graciously opened his house to Charles during those last days. Jay was kind enough to bring along a bunch of copies of Olson in Connecticut, a second issue with a preface, a new introduction by Phil Fielding Dawson. And he was just showing me the book that has a picture of a tree where the two Charleses sat overlooking the Connecticut Valley.
Knowlton Hill Estate.
Knowlton Hill Estate. So if anyone hasn't read that book, I would really suggest they snag a copy, because it really is a wonderful, tells a lot about the man, and you get a real sense of him. And all the proceeds of the book are going to go towards the Writers' Center. About 10 years ago, Kenny Rieff and I had a great day with Charles Bohr. He drove up for an interview for Polis Is This. And when he came up here, he had this beautiful old map that was Olson's that he said he needed to bring back to Gloucester. So we haven't found a place for it here yet, but ultimately it'll end up here. So he had Charles had a bunch of chronic medical issues, and soon after that interview, I heard he was in assisted living, and then he finally ended up in hospice. And on November 18th, Jay says he passed away after a good meal, peacefully, with no pain or trauma. Jay was a PhD student in language and psychology at UConn, where he met Charles in 84. He, Charles Bohr, and the preeminent Jungian psychologist James Hillman participated in a workshop with the Roy Hart Theater in France. Jay writes that we were there to see for ourselves what this group, influenced by Jung's thought, was doing with multiple voices and voice extension, and what, if any, were its psychological or even mythological implications for our ideas and writings. The people at Roy Hart must have liked him, because from 2005 to 11, he was director of the Centre Artiste International Roy Hart. The center is based on a history of more than 80 years of research, study, and practice of the human voice without boundaries. And like this place, the Gloucester Writers' Center, Roy Hart's work believes that there is no separation between life and art. Over subsequent years, Jay participated in numerous workshops and lectured on a range of subjects or at events sponsored by Enrique Pardo Pan Theater and the French government. In 2012, he presented his lecture, A Feast for the Ears Means Food for Soul, Orpheus and Psychoanalysis in Brazil. And today he's an executive director and publisher of Abraxas Publishing. So with that, Jay Livernois.
Thank you, Henry. Wonderful introduction. And all I have to say is life has taken certain bends beyond that, as we all know. As you might imagine, given that introduction in life, institutions are not necessarily supportive of people on the fringe. As a result, we have to find our own platform, or make our own platform. As I was talking with Garrett Lansing about that earlier this evening, he contacted me and generously agreed to have dinner with my wife and me, my French wife, from the Roy Hart Theater. And what we're doing right now, which came out of this Abraxas Voice Institute, we realized when we brought people from around the world to a wonderful location between New York and Boston to do this kind of work and training, we didn't have any place for them to eat well. We you know, I mean, it was really a problem. I mean, eat well, but inexpensively. And we had done this in the south of France. And as a result, we said, well, we have to, I found myself cooking for these people lunch and dinner, you know, 2 weeks at a time. I said, I might as well open a bistro, a cafe. And so we went through the process and we've done that. And what happened is we have, of course, in a bistro, you have wall space. We have great collections of all kinds of interesting art. So we put that up there. And we figured maybe a few people will wander in. I'm related to about half the town and I have a few friends. And so we opened this very simple, traditional bistro, and we've exploded. And rather than absolutely setting up a cultural center or a writer's center or anything that you've done here, we found out that we could do it right in this bistro. And my wife, who is this wonderful performer who sings a cappella in 8 different languages, get to do that. I get to basically talk about anyone I wanted to. I put poems of Charles Olson on the wall with all kinds of different photos, and put things, as you know, on the website, poems by Charles Bohr, this and that, and people love it. We've just absolutely exploded. So we're definitely fringe people, and this really came from it. And of course, Charles Bohr was a big supporter of it, and I have to tell you something about Charles right now, and I mentioned this to Garrett because Garrett invited him to speak at an Olson conference at MIT a few years ago, and Charles claimed that he could not come because he was in a wheelchair. Well, Charles was a mythologist. Charles was really a recluse, and he really didn't like contact with people. It's amazing, Henry, amazing that he came up to do the film, because at that time he was speaking to 3 people. Peter Kugler, me, and of course the wonderful blonde he brought along as arm candy, and everyone wondered and amazed, like, what is this man doing with this gorgeous woman? That was it. And other than that, he really was a recluse, and he wrote a book about it, which is unpublished, which will be published, called The Pleasure of Recluses. And it is a superb work. And Echo Press had agreed to publish it, but at the 1999, they withdrew. There was a change, some kind of internal change, sale, things of that nature. I don't remember exactly the players. And he was very disappointed that it had been withdrawn from publication. And then 9/11 happened. And for Charles, that was a shock. Because Charles had moved from the world of poetry and esotericism and psychology into the stock market. And he was very successful at it. And he was his own broker. I mean, he did not go through any broker. He basically gambled, is what he was doing, and made a lot of money and gave it away. And was enjoying the whole thing. And he loved the idea, going back to Olson, that in being in the stock market, you had to know everything. I mean, if you read Olson, my sense, maybe I'm wrong here, but Olson believed you had to know everything. From Congolium, which was a type of linoleum that was being marketed and sold in the 40s and 50s, to second millennium archaeology, what was going on. And Charles found that fascinating in terms of the market, that you could then bet money. And Charles believed that money was soul and soul was money. You could bet your blood in this way. And he took all his mythological training and began playing the stock market and was successful. Now, what he did was he gave the money mostly away. And what's interesting about that is he didn't let on, he was again a recluse. He didn't let on where the money went or who he gave it to, and so a lot of people have this belief that he died with an awful lot of money. He didn't. He wasn't uncomfortable, but he had given, and he believed he really did practice what he believed in terms of those things, and again, it's quite an interesting contrast how he moved from all his interests into the markets, and he just found it fascinating. But he read it mythologically, and he would watch the financial channels on television all day, nonstop. Then he would write poems in the evening. And he combined the two in a very interesting way. I guess the closest thing we can see is Ezra Pound, who wrote about economics. No one has put this together, that fascination with poetry and culture and then economics. It's usually, you know, Pound's economics is usually dismissed in a certain way. But Charles Bohr really understood that and did that. So, as an aside here, let me begin by thanking the Gloucester's Writers' Center for inviting me to speak this evening. This is my first time in Gloucester, and all I can say is that Charles Bohr always spoke highly of the place, and in recent years he was impressed that the center has been created from Vincent Farini's house, which we're sitting in now. Charles Bohr's last visit here to Gloucester, of course, was the filming of the film on Charles Olson in Gloucester, and he was very impressed by that, and he certainly distributed it to all three of his friends. So, the subject of my talk this evening, Charles Bohr, who was he? Charles was born in Cleveland on the 25th of June, 1939, into an upper middle class German French Catholic family. He always claimed, up until his death, that he was Dutch, Bohr. But in fact, I found out from his papers that he was German on his father's side, not Dutch whatsoever. Why he disclaimed that, I have no idea. All I know is that the papers were there, and he hadn't destroyed them, and his sister wanted them. Why is that important? Because part of Charles's incredible sense of culture, literature, his genius, was coming from that part of his background, that wonderful 19th century German culture that, of course, was so blown up by 20th century political events, particularly with the Nazis. Charles was, of course, as a little genius, was a talented student. He was very good in writing and very musical. He graduated from St. Joseph's Catholic High School in Cleveland, which was and is run by the Marion Brothers. He always let on that somehow he had been, in fact, taught by Jesuits, because the Jesuits are the more nasty, strict, say, Catholics in the education field. But in effect, it was the Marion Brothers. When he graduated, he received both the Latin and English prizes, and he was supposed to attend Notre Dame in Indiana. But instead, he came home to his family, declared that he no longer believed in Catholicism whatsoever, this is at 18, and that he was going to study with the Jews at Western Reserve. Of course, that's where he meets Harvey Brown and Harvey Pekar. Does anyone know who Harvey Pekar was? Exactly. Amazing. Don't let me forget this. I'll get back to that, how that comes about. But there's a whole thing there, which was just an amazing story. And Harvey Brown, Garrett Lansing, knew Harvey Brown quite well. And again, that's for a side at the end. Charles goes to Western Reserve, absolutely brilliant. He graduates summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa. And, of course, there he has his teachers, Albert Cook and Mack Hammond, people who are very important in relation to the Olson constellation later on. From that, he receives a Fulbright to Florence. And he also receives, at the same time, a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship to study classics at Harvard. So he has a problem. What to do? He gets them both. So he's able to delay the Woodrow Wilson for a year and goes to Florence for a Fulbright. There, he studies moral philosophy with one of the great Italian scholars, Eugenio Guerin, for a year. And what does he study? He studies Dante in the original Italian with private lessons, tutorials, lives in Florence, can't believe it. Totally magical time. He comes back because they were willing to give him another year. The reason they're going to give Charles Bohr another year, this is something that many people don't know about Charles Bohr, while he's in Florence, he's working for the CIA. This is the Cold War. Okay? He is a consummate spy. He does extremely well. Both governments want him to continue, but Harvard says no. Harvard, with all their different spies, the most classic one, of course, who was a colonel, Henry Murray. Okay, he's a colonel at this time in the CIA. He is Olson's friend. He's the one who turns Olson on to LSD. He, of course, is part of he's also the one who creates the Unabomber. Charles Bohr's last essay that he wrote and published in Spring Publications is Harvard and the Unabomber. He has inside information of this, and I will be sending copies here if anyone is interested in having them. But fascinating, fascinating material. So Harvard blocks him from continuing on, so he attends Harvard. He's in classes, particularly with John Finley, the great classicist, who was also a teacher of Charles Olson. He absolutely hates it, cannot stand it. Spoken like a graduate or someone. But the thing is, he just absolutely despises it. He can't believe he's doing this. The Cuban Missile Crisis is occurring, and here he is concerned about Greek coinage. He views it as absolutely irrelevant, and he quits. He leaves, and he decides he's going to go into and become a stockbroker. He goes back to Cleveland. At that point, he's in the Cleveland Art Museum, and he runs into Al Cook looking at paintings. And Al Cook says, "Charles Bohr, what are you doing here?" And he says, "Well, I hated Harvard. I couldn't stand it after Florence. The food was miserable. everything was horrible. I couldn't stand it. So I've resigned, and I'm going to become a stockbroker." Al Cook says, "Well, hey, I've just been given a new position as the chairman of the English department at the University of State University of New York in Buffalo, and I'm bringing all these great guys, all these great, wonderful people. I just got Charles Olson to come. He's going to teach there, and I have all these different people, Mac Hammond," and so he goes through the list, and he says, "Why don't you come, and you come as a graduate student, and I will give you a position, and you'll teach, and if you don't like it, you can quit. That'll be fine, no problem, but give it a try before you become a stockbroker." So Charles says, "Okay, all right, I'll go and do that." So he goes there, and he loves it. He finds every night he's dancing in the street. This is when the State University of Buffalo was located in downtown Buffalo, not outside. It was right, the campus was right there, and it was a wonderful place because you're in the city, and you had all these things, and he just absolutely loved it. And he tells a story of one night, there were so many good speakers from Olson was speaking, and I'm at the age now, as my mother used to say, you have CRS, can't remember shit. And I didn't write it down here, but Marshall McLuhan was speaking, and the great English poet who wrote Goodbye to All That, He wrote The White Goddess. Robert Graves was also speaking the same. He said it was terrible. You'd have on one night you couldn't decide who to go, who to see, and whatever. But he absolutely loved it. And he said after a few years, lo and behold, they give you a PhD, which he received a PhD in comparative literature, and he was recruited. Charles was recruited by Wesleyan to go and teach there, partly through the Olson connection. Olson, of course, was still alive at that point, although he was no longer teaching at Buffalo because when his wife was killed tragically in a car accident, he then left and returned to Gloucester. And anyway, through Olson, that connection, Wesleyan was very interested. They recruited him and basically had offered, giving him a job. He goes to Wesleyan. And he goes for an interview. He finds everyone very depressed. Again, Wesleyan's a little Ivy League school. His sense was that everyone was on the verge of committing suicide, and he couldn't stand it. He hated it. He said, "What the hell is this?" So what he does is his second choice was UConn. This public school had offered, they wanted to interview him a job. And so he calls them up. He says, "Is there any possibility that I could come up and maybe be interviewed by you again? I'm at Wesleyan and I'm here." And the chairman of the department says, "No problem. We understand what you're going through. We have an ice cold gin and tonic waiting for you. So when you get here," and he says, "Wow, that's my kind of place to go to, So he goes up and loves it and is hired. As a result, he flourishes. He's a big star, even though he had worked for the CIA. He was very much anti-Vietnam War. He was, in fact, quite a radical to the point of 1968-69, where the radical party that he was connected with, group, they expelled him. The communist parties, they don't even talk about communists, whatever. They always have that. They expel different factions and things that they go on. He was expelled because they viewed him as too bourgeois because he drank wine. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. He was kicked out of the Spartacus because he drank wine and he wasn't drinking beer. I see the gentleman there going for a glass of wine. But so again, he was very much involved in it, but he was a big star. And of course he's publishing, he's writing poetry, his odes are being published. These are all things that books that have been published over the years by Charles. His first book of poems were the odes. And then he did, given the age, he did a thing called Varmint Q, which is an epic poem on William Confederate guerrilla leader William Clark Quantrell, called Varmint Q. Members of his gang were, of course, the Youngers and the James brothers, who then flourish in American mythology. And again, Charles's approach to this was very Olsonian. How do you read these stories? How do you see this in terms of mythology? And then he writes this stuff up, which is absolutely brilliant. And again, hopefully in the next years, these things will come out again. Back to my little lecture here. At this point, when he's at UConn, he's a star. He's young. He's popular, and he gets the phone call, as we all know, from Charles Olson. This work, if you don't have it, it's here. It's available, and I'm going to just read the beginning of it to give you a sense of how this works. "Charlie, how are you?" It was your best campaign voice, your hurried-up telephone voice suddenly booming in my ear. You always made it sound like the telephone had just been invented and might give out at any minute. "I'm fine, Charles," I said. "How are you?" Well, I'm okay. I mean, I'm all right. I'm on the road, or at least the railroad. I'm at the train station in Gloucester taking a vacation, and I was wondering how it would be if I came down to pay you a visit. I was delighted. I invited you to Connecticut many times, but it was like inviting the Pope. I never really expected you to come. It was a rare day anymore when Charles Olson was willing to leave Gloucester. Only a few weeks before, on my way back from a trip to Newfoundland, I stopped off at your apartment. When I walked up the back steps, you were sitting on the porch reading a postcard I had sent, which by some coincidence had just arrived. The postcard said that I was on an expedition in search of Viking ruins and wouldn't come back without some. Quote, "Well, don't look at me," you said in greeting. You had yourself just returned from a short visit to Maine with your daughter. That trip had only confirmed your reluctance to travel, you said. You were happy that summer was over, happy that Gloucester would soon lose its summer crowds and return to its ordinary hard business as a fishing port. With the tourist season behind it for another year, Gloucester's restaurants, a little richer, would be Olson's again. Its news, via the Gloucester Times, would supply serious daily reading once more. Its streets would again be your merciless talking ground. The poet of Gloucester could get back to work. Or it seemed then. Now suddenly you had changed your mind and wanted out. I was too excited by the prospect of your coming to ask why. I immediately offered to drive up to get you a distance of 100 miles, but you insisted on coming by train. You love trains. Unfortunately, there was no train to Mansfield, Connecticut. There had not been one in years. The nearest train station was in Hartford, 25 miles to the west. No train, you said, as if astounded by the news. Your enthusiasm for the whole venture appeared to fade. I assured you that I could drive to Gloucester in no time, but your heart was absolutely set on a train ride. I got the impression, in fact, that you had gone to the train station before you even knew where you wanted to go. You decided to take the train as far as Boston, where I'd meet you with my car. You started naming restaurants there where we could meet, but most of those you named had closed years ago, and you had never heard of the ones I named. We finally settled on that old Teutonic standby, the worst house in Harvard Square. It was Friday. Right, it doesn't exist anymore. Rented out by the Porcelain, which is upstairs, the club, they bought it and rented out to Starbucks. It's totally a business transaction. It's Congolium. It was Friday, September 26, 1969. It took me an hour and a half to drive from Mansfield to Cambridge, and it should have taken you only half an hour on the train from Gloucester. But I arrived at the restaurant first and was waiting for you outside for at least another half hour. I began to wonder if you had changed your mind, if you had found a more interesting train to somewhere else, if you had got on a Pullman, perhaps, and were now comfortably asleep in Rhode Island. And then you appeared, bobbing leisurely up the street, always slower than anyone else by at least half. You walked slowly because of your size, all 6 feet 8 inches of it, and because Charles Olson was one man who would never be rushed. I don't know if you know that famous phrase of Olson's. Olson at one point said to Charles Bohr, I think it's in this book, maybe I could be wrong, is that a man stands on 4 legs. Be romantic, be imaginative, be passionate, but never be rushed. Dressed in old corduroys and work boots, a heavy winter overcoat over a sweater, your winter cap perched loosely on top with its flaps dropping over the ears, you seem ready for the Arctic Circle. Not this warm fall afternoon in Cambridge. And you were smiling, laughing even, all the way up the street once you spotted me waving to you. You look great. We went into the restaurant and ordered bratwurst and beer. With an affectionate grasp of the waitress's wrist, you insisted that it be a good piece of meat, dear. She was amused. This was Olson, the teaser of waitresses, a role I had seen you play many times. When the bratwurst came, you took one bite and abandoned it. When the waitress came back and saw that you hadn't eaten it, She became very solicitous and asked if you wanted her to take it back for something else. You indulged her solicitude for all it was worth, but wouldn't send the bratwurst back. Anyway, that's the opening of Charles Olson in Connecticut. And if you haven't read it, I highly recommend that you pick up a copy here and read it in a night. So, where was I? As you might know, Olson stays in Connecticut for 3 months. And what happens is he comes as a visitor, drives Charles Bourque almost crazy and dead within a matter of less than 2 weeks. And Charles throws him out of his house in Mansfield. He's not living at that time in Pomfret. And Olson flourishes and continues to live and work in Connecticut. And I brought something for a little fetish item for the Gloucester Writers Center. Henry, would you come over here, please? Besides the books, this is something that I had made that I discovered, and I think it should be here. These are the last checks of Charles Olson. I mean, it sounds crazy, but it's one of these things that these are the checks
make
that
out for $1 million.
These are of all places it should be. You never know. Hey, maybe you need some money sometime. Who knows what auction? You know, who knows? But it's one of those. What's happening with a lot of the museums and collections? Of course, these type of items have. I call them fetish items. I don't mean to do that as a denigration, but it's one of those nice little things. And I thought, damn it, I'm going to come here. I'm going to get this together for you because these things get thrown out, and it's kind of it's dated, and there it is. So, all right, where was I here? So he's there, and he gets hired again. I don't want to ruin the book for anyone here that's that hasn't read it. But, of course, as you know, he dies in 1970. Part of the premonition you should know here is that it seems that Olson knew that he had terminal cancer, was dying, and that's why he left. That's very clear in Charles's writing, but also what's going on, why he does leave. But again, I don't want to say too much more of that. But for Charles, this was Charles Bourque. It was a seminal event in his life, as you might imagine. Here is his great mentor, the person who had changed his life, and comes there, very major figure, and dies. It's so powerful in some respects. Charles, who had this wonderful house in Mansfield, Connecticut, that he was renting. He moves and gets away from the area where he gets away from stores. He buys a house in Pomfret, Connecticut, which at that time, in some respects even now, was the Arctic Circle. Really, it was way out there. And he buys this little, in fact, it's the second oldest house in Pomfret. It was built in 1692. And very isolated, but he could live anonymously. He never had his phone was never in the phone book. People couldn't contact him. He would go and teach. Extremely popular. He explodes at this point. When I take him as a student, he has classes of 350 students. He is charismatic, brilliant lecturer. And he's in his 30s. He's single. And you know what that means, given America, right? And he hides. One day, after I got to know him, I drive up, and there's a tent on his front yard. And I say, Charles, what the hell is this? He says, I have no idea. It was one of his students who'd fallen in love with him. Nothing went on. He was absolutely, from everything I knew, nothing absolutely on. This woman had gone there and camped and actually put her tent. This is in the 70s. Now, you know, he just wanted no part of it. There's a lot of reasons for that, but it was just stunning, those type of things that would go on. And he would have it both for male and female students. Another time, in the early 80s, there was a male student who had ridden his bicycle and pitched his tent and camped there and was going to, and Charles just said, you know, so Garrett Lansing told me the story where he invited Charles, and Charles claimed that he was in a wheelchair and couldn't come out or anything. But in fact, unfortunately, that wasn't true. He was just a complete recluse and really did not want to have any kind of public life whatsoever. Again, as I say, it's amazing that he came out here to do this, to do the film at all, because normally he wouldn't have done that. Now, where did Charles's energy go? He does a translation of the Homeric hymns, which hadn't been done for 60 years. It's so good, again, heavily influenced by Olson, that he is nominated for the National Book Award in, this is 1971. Because of his political activities and things of that nature, anti-war, anti-Vietnam, he doesn't believe he's going to receive tenure. In fact, he does receive tenure. All his friends that he's involved with, Charlie Brover, some of you might have heard of, Charles Doria, they don't. Charles gets tenure. Not only that, but by the age of 35, which is rather unheard of, when he publishes Olson and Charles Olson in Connecticut, he in fact is made a full professor. Now, part of the reason is just pure economics and numbers. You're not going to not give tenure to a professor who has between 250 and 350 students every single semester for a course on mythology. Why? He's making jobs for basically a half dozen of your friends if you're chairman of the department. And that's exactly what went on. No question about it. And part of the thing with his mythology class, again, owes it awful lot to Olson, but he called it mythology, but what he taught was Homer, Ovid, Shakespeare, Dante, Pound, Olson. It was basically all these epics that you had to master as an undergraduate. And he was accused, because he was so popular, but he was just an absolutely brilliant lecturer, that he was what they called a gut, which meant you're a very easy grader and all that. In fact, he didn't grade on a bell curve, but he graded basically whether people, you know, got it or not. And when I, for his little tombstone, he's buried in Southbridge, Massachusetts now, I will have, because he always said what he wanted on his tombstone was his name, dates, and a gut. Whether anyone remembers what the hell that's going to mean in the future, who knows, but that's going on that stone. Just before he died, I happened to find in my papers the final exam that he gave in 1975 for his course in mythology. And again, course in with 350 students. And I looked at it, and the complexity, the difficulty, I couldn't believe. So I thought this would be fun. I bring it to him. I said, you know, Charles, here's your final exam from 1975. You always claimed you were easy. And he looks at it, and he couldn't answer three quarters of the questions he asked. And he said, you made this up. I said, no, Charles, this is the original. This is the real thing. And he says, no, you son of a bitch. I didn't write this. No way that I did this. My wife was there. Mary Paul was there. He was very upset. He said, oh, my God, I was terrible. What a terrible professor that I would ask these questions. Oh, my God. He was just absolutely destroyed that he, in fact, had done that. And then he finally had to admit that, it was original. That was his thing there. And But as they say, he was, if anyone ever heard him lecture or speak, he was absolutely the best public speaker I've ever heard. Funny, brilliant, humorous, insightful, and he really worked it. All right, get back to Charles Bohr, and in some respect, Garrett Lansing here. Charles Olson dies, and his Charles Bohr's life changes. He comes to a dead end. He doesn't know where to go or what to do, because Olson for him represents an end to a kind of sense of life and literature, but where else to pick it up? Now, Olson also had this interest in psychology, particularly Jungian psychology, although it was tangential, but he had that there. And one of Charles Bohr's students, who was also a student of Charles Olson in Connecticut, was Paul Kugler and his brother Peter. Both of them go off into psychology. Paul goes off, and again, they're both in Charles Olson, they're both still alive. They go off, Paul goes off to the Jung Institute in Zurich, and there he meets another charismatic, brilliant person, James Hillman, psychologist James Hillman, in Zurich. And James Hillman is connected with the Eranos Foundation, which is better known or best known today as the place where the history of religion really in the 20th century got its kind of invention and start. And Jung was part of it, but it carried on much more than that. So James Hillman is there, and he's one of the main, he really is one of the lecturers on psychology. Of course, they have all the different disciplines, philosophy, Islamic studies, Oriental studies. It was founded in 1933 by a woman. It was a think tank. This woman was Olga Freiberg-Kaptein, a Dutch woman, and she founded it in Ascona to really bring the ideas of the East to meet with different ideas of the West, particularly esoteric ideas, but esoteric in the best sense. And she brought this together and did that brilliantly, absolutely brilliantly. And what happens is Hillman is involved in this, Paul Kugler goes down, and then Charles goes to there. And there you meet some of the great luminaries of this type of thought in the world. Henri Corbin, Eric Neumann, let's see, of course, Jung had been there, Louis Massignon, Gershom Scholem. All these different themes come together. And along with James Hillman, particularly in terms of psychology and revisioning in a postmodern way, really the ideas of the founders of Freud and Jung. And this is what goes on there. So Charles Bohr gets taken up by this. And of course, he comes in as the mythologist. He's taking Olson ideas of mythology, and he's bringing that into Eranos. Now, they always had a certain sense of it, but this is where he's very important, particularly as Hillman is developing a thing called archetypal psychology, which is a post depth psychology. So from there, Charles Bohr gets picked up by James Hillman, and as he's formulating a thing called archetypal psychology, which is best personified, if you haven't read it, I highly do, it's called Revisioning Psychology. It's a series of lectures that he gave at Yale, on the Terry Lectures, and it's just absolutely his best work, superb. But Charles Bohr comes in, and what he does is gives a mythological spin to it. Now, just a small break here. Does anyone have any questions before I continue on about this Olson connection and Charles Bohr?
Henry? I have a lot of questions myself.
What about Butterick? Was Butterick there before Charles
No.
Bohr was there?
No. George Butterick was brought in by Charles Bohr.
Oh.
Butterick was a year younger than Charles, starting out in the University of Buffalo. And Charles brought George into University of Connecticut. Part of the thing for Charles was dealing with, as the executor of the Olson estate, was a trauma for him. I met Charles in 1974 when he was 35 years old. He looked, to me at the time, 55. And I asked him, what happened? And he said, this goddamn Olson state. Because realize the Olson state was contested by distant cousins. Because Olson's two children were never legitimized. So these two distant cousins brought lawyers, and it was in court for 8 years. The probate of the estate was 8 years. And that was a consistent drain on Charles. So that was a real... And what Charles did was bring in Butterick as someone who had a connection with it, but hadn't been named as the executor. Charles was the named executor, no question about that. But bringing in George, who of course knew, was friends with Olson, knew that, was a dedicated scholar. It was a way that Charles was doing the politics to get the University of Connecticut, which had no, it was a state university, had no special collections, had none of those things, get them to purchase, as a start, the Olson papers, which was a huge thing. They had nothing, absolutely nothing. But because he was hired by the university, it was a conflict of interest. So George coming in was someone to take that pressure off. Because they could always say, oh, well, you're a professor in the English department. That's why you're doing this and doing all these different things here, bringing that on there. And that's how George came in. It was, again, they were friends. It was a brilliant pick, as you know. Anyone who knew George Butterick, he was just a superb person and, a very good scholar. And look at all the work that he did while he was there, which relatively short time, about 15 years. Before he died.
Is it too long a story to talk about how Bauer became Olson's executor?
Not at all. He became his executor because, let's go right back to the book. The intimations there is, it seems that Olson knew he had cancer. Olson seemed to know that he was dying. Charles Bohr was one of the squarest, straightest, most boring people you can imagine in that sense. And he was someone who was going, if you told him to do this, he would do it, invariably. And that's why I believe that Charles Olson chose Charles Bohr to do that. There's intimations, even in Charles writing that. Now, I think there were other documents where that would be confirmed, but...
Bohr didn't talk about any of this interaction, any of this...
Oh, yes.
Or,
oh, yes. Well, oh, with me. Totally, oh, with me.
How'd it go down?
Well, Olson went to... I mean, Olson is dying... He makes greater and greater demands upon Charles, and Charles refuses. He doesn't want to do it. Doesn't want to be part of it, even to the point of refusal. But he, Olson was this great, charismatic figure, and imposed. So Charles felt and did take it on, and it was very clearly. Again, Olson didn't have anyone really to do that. I mean, you have to understand that was the thing. He looked to Charles because he viewed him correctly as a very square, responsible person who wore a tie, that type of person, and he did do it. But at the same time, it was a huge burden because Olson never legitimized his marriages, his children, things today that we take, that's just normal. But at that time, it does create problems. I mean, it does create problems in terms of your succession. So if anyone here doesn't have a will... or doesn't have that organized, I assure you, please, please do it. As I am the executive of Charles Bohr's estate, I can tell you there are certain things that I argued with him, fought with him about that he didn't do. Unfortunately, at the last moments, talk about education in America. These are some of the things that you really should know and that we should really teach people, but you just don't. And you're at the mercy of lawyers who aren't always gracious about it, but believe me, those are huge, huge things. And They have in the, and I've seen them. You know, Olson's idea of a will. He took a napkin. It's not even a napkin. What can I say? A kitchen paper towel in the hospital, and wrote by hand what his wishes were, which of course was completely disallowed by the court, and it would create a huge problem. But that he did certainly did it. There are copies of the, I don't know where the original is, probably in the University of Connecticut, but it's, I've seen actually, they actually photographed, I actually, you know, have those things, because all that material from that probate, which was not in the Olson archives until Charles died, he kept them, and letters that have never been seen or published by Olson to him, they're all at the University of Connecticut now, because his wish was that they go there, and that's where they are. But that was one of the big problems. Absolutely, it was a monster of stress for him in that sense. And so, as a result, his break in his liberation was to go into the world of psychology, but depth psychology. So it still contained mythology, still contained imagination. It wasn't an orthodoxy. It wasn't a Freudian type of formulaic thing, but was to go off into that world, which he did brilliantly, to the point where he retires not long afterwards in 1992 at age 53. And in the meantime, with Hillman, he writes a book, which if you have not... Part of the thing with Charles Bohr was... He had a wonderful sense of humor, just absolutely brilliant sense of humor. And the trouble being his friend is I always felt I was the straight guy. And he wrote a book with James Hillman called Freud's Own Cookbook. Now, this cookbook are actual recipes adapted to Freudian psychology, but as jokes. So it combines three things: humor, actual cooking, and Freudian psychology in a commentary. It's called Freud's Own Cookbook. Now, the problem with this book is that many people think it's real. They believe that this is actually, that Freud actually wrote a cookbook. In Japan, this book has been translated into 28 different languages. It was the best-selling book of James Hillman before The Soul's Code. It's the only book that ever made any money. And there is a restaurant in Kyoto to this day that is dedicated to the recipes and this book. They have it there with this whole display, and they really believe it was Sigmund Freud who wrote this. It's crazy. You know, it's one of these great things. It's one of the greatest jokes you can imagine internationally. And the irony is, The picture that was drawn of Sigmund Freud is actually James Hillman, which is another joke. James Hillman didn't have the beard, but it's James Hillman. It's his glasses. It's everything. You know, it's very funny. But that work, you know, really moved him out of that. Charles Bohr also has written several. First of all, his dissertation. As at Buffalo was on laughter, on humor, and then he wrote another book on a thing called Archetypal Laughter. All these things which had never been published, and then of course it all comes together with this thing called Freud's Own Cookbook. So some of the things we're talking about, they put on the back here. Quote: I didn't know he could cook. In fact, I didn't know men could cook. Alma Mahler. Quote, reading this book was sweet and painful for me. It brought back so much the rich aromas of Schnecken and Stolen of my youth. Thomas Mann. So, eat your way to sanity the Freudian way with recipes from Sigmund Freud's long-suppressed private cookbook. Here is the definitive work Freud would have given us had he not been distracted by his patients, anxieties, and professional articles. As the master himself writes, quote, Enough has been recorded of what we said, yet not one word of what we ate, unquote. These are the authentic dishes which not only delighted those pioneers of the pleasure principle, but nourished them as well. With these recipes are Freud's intimate revelations about his colleagues' and patients' mouths, their gastronomical peculiarities, and some of his own, and previously unpublished reflections on his theories, including civilization and its indigestion, and luncheon interruptus. The truth comes out about Jung's fainting spells and Freud's lifelong dislike of children. Of chicken. Replete with source notes, editor's comments, index, tips on technique, and delighted illustrations of the Vienna Circle at table. Freud's own cookbook is essential for those who only know oral eroticism as a theory. Now everyone can try it, as Freud did, in the privacy of the kitchen.
What year was that published?
This is published in 1985. I mean, but it's filled exactly, and again, this was not written by a hack at some, this was written by Charles Bohr and James Hillman together. Again, I was there. This came about in 1983. Previous to that, Charles and I used to play a game called Psychological Food and what that would be. And one of the things was, one of the things we came up with, what's paranoid pie? It's only crust, and so we began playing these games. You know, Jung food, of course. You know, right? Jung food. I mean, this is an obvious one. You know, no one's written a book on Jung food. I mean, really. And Hillman was over for lunch with his second wife after we played tennis. We used to play tennis doubles together, and we began playing this game. Charles Bohr, by the way, was an excellent tennis player. He was gangly, gawky, and I have no pictures of him here this evening. The reason for that is I believe a word is worth a thousand pictures, but he was a very good tennis player. We played many years, and we also played doubles. And James Hillman was a good tennis player. So afterwards at lunch, we were talking about this, and they found it so fascinating. They put together. All four of us put together a proposition that was then sent to Harper and Rowe at the time, now Harper and Collins. And the editor there just loved it to such a degree that he gave the largest advance that Hillman had ever received, which was $15,000. And this was in 1983. From there, it developed, and they wrote this book, and then it was published in 85. But it's a great read. Unfortunately, it's no longer in print, not because it wasn't selling, but James Hillman was, he's now passed away, a notoriously bad business person. And I worked for him for many years. I worked as an editor and worked. I ran his press, and I can honestly tell you, he made just disastrous decisions one after another after another. And it was very hard to argue with someone like that who was also brilliant in another area. But the fact of the matter is, he decided in the early 2000s, this is a book that had consistently sold for almost 20 years, was in all these different languages. He decided to take over the copyright and was going to, you know, publish it himself, but really didn't have it. And as a result, it didn't go anywhere. I mean, just didn't work whatsoever. But now that both James Hillman and Charles Bohr have passed away, we'll see what can happen, because that's one of those things that, as you're laughing, I realize we're all of a certain age here, and you get the jokes. Well, maybe it's one of those type of works that just needs to be out there. And again, the great thing with the internet is you can put those type of works out there. You don't have to have them anymore in this, you know, this format. You know, but it just makes wonderful reading and wonderful insights.
May I ask if you're responsible for those kind of decisions now?
Yes, I am.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Idea.
Anyway, yes, they will happen. It takes a little time, but they will happen. Anyway, how much time do we have? It's now almost 8:45, Henry.
Well, I think you should.
I can stop right here and ask for questions.
Yeah, we can just continue talking.
Yeah, I would rather do that. I mean, I can go on afterwards.
Wine.
Yeah, I prefer that because
a glass of wine.
Yeah, everyone should have glasses of wine. No, I mean, we can, you know, any questions I'll be glad to take. And the reason is I have more to go here, but I think that this is an appropriate point to stop with Freud's Own Cookbook to see where Charles made a move out of Olsonia, let's say, into another thing because he had died, and he had to make that move. And as we all know, with death, it's an ending, but also it moves you into other areas, which is not necessarily a bad thing. And maybe this is to be continued, maybe it isn't. I will put this stuff, write this stuff up in the future. But I'd like to hear from you in terms of questions. Yes?
Yeah, so then...
Not for another 20 years.
Okay, so did
no 20 no another a 30 another 30 years.
Then he published a lot more after that.
Well, he didn't. He didn't. And again, after that, the only books, well, besides working with Spring Journal, which Charles Bohr and I did for 15 years. This is the last edition that we did together. It's called Education. Let's see. Yeah. See me, I asked the question. You can have that copy. How's that?
Thank you. Come on.
No, I'm serious. It's fine. I'm not going to carry all those back. He also, the other thing we did was we were very involved in starting the spoken word process. This was the late 80s, early 90s, and he did a collection of readings, which was called Just Goddesses, and they were reading his translations from Ovid and the Homeric hymns, which dealt with just goddesses, and he thought with the new different interest in women and these type of things that people would buy it. Well, he was sorely mistaken. He was as mistaken as when he offered a course in Gertrude Stein at the University of Connecticut. And he put it as the person offering it was C. period Bohr. The women showing up did not know that it was a man teaching this course. Talk about sexism. They were furious. What are you doing teaching Gertrude Stein? And Charles loved Gertrude Stein, you know, and all that. He was brilliant about it. They hated it, and they hated him. He went from the highest ranked professor in the university to the lowest within a matter of a semester. And they couldn't understand, what did you do? And he taught Gertrude Stein. I mean, sympathetically. I mean, I was in the course. I assure you it was very sympathetic and very nice. But it just the fact that he... And again, in selling this, they said, "Well, you know, I got this criticism. If it was a woman who did this, you could sell it. But it's a man who wrote this. Absolutely not." At that point, the next year, Charles Bohr said, "I've had it. I'm not going to be in this world of this political correctness or whatever." And that's when he retired early. And he then thought he would teach at a school in California called the Pacifica Graduate Institute, which is doing some interesting things. Again, I have more copies of these different things with Charles, but they're very well read. Other questions?
It said it's translated, though. I mean, I thought you said this is Gertrude Stein, no?
No, he taught a course.
I see.
But it just like his bomb of a course in Gertrude Stein. Now, then the next semester, he decided that he would teach one of the students, one of the mentees of Gertrude Stein in Paris, that was very much at a low. And he figured he was basically trying to deconstruct and subvert his myth class because he just didn't want to teach 300 students anymore. So he wanted to have a smaller class. So he figured, I'll teach a course that no one will show up for, Ernest Hemingway. Who reads Hemingway? This is, and guess what happened? He had 560 students show up. He couldn't believe it. Like, what the hell was this? You know, I mean, I go from, and he had the lowest ranking of any professor teaching, and then he offers a course and he gets over 500 students wanting to take his course on Hemingway. And again, Hemingway in the university was and still is. I mean, they barely teach him, if anyone does. But when he did, all of a sudden the students rushed. It was really crazy.
What year was that?
That was in 1990, the fall of 91, and he retired in the spring of 92. And that was it. He said, "That's it. I'm out of here." Part of the reason was that the University of Connecticut, they figured that they do this whole actuarial tables, and basically people who they offered him early retirement because they made it such that if he continued teaching, he would not make any more money than if he retired early, because he'd still receive the annual raises or might be. So he said, "What am I doing teaching?" And then he figured correctly that he could teach at another school, which he did briefly. But again, being a person on the edge and very controversial, he was only there for 3 years. For basically, they de facto fired him. Because he was very controversial. He would say things that people, you know, would get uncomfortable with.
Jim,
yes, Henry.
Do you know if Charles was like dabbling in any in his stock brokerage? If he was like buying any marijuana stocks? And if so, which ones were they?
It's very interesting you asked that question. Charles certainly in the 50s and 60s, given all the different characters he knew, and even in the 70s and even up to the early 80s, certainly smoked grass, you know, occasionally. When he was at Harvard, he was part of Henry Murray's CIA experiments with acid, which also Charles Olson, as you know, was part of. I need some more. And of course, he tells this wonderful story of tripping, taking a massive dose of acid and tripping at Harvard over Good Friday and all that. So he certainly was not naive with all those things. But that wasn't his real thing. His real thing was wine. He really enjoyed that. And a cognac or a port. I mean, he absolutely, besides being a recluse, he was an Epicurean. And he certainly enjoyed smoking all kinds of tobacco, except when it impinged upon his health. And he had such discipline that he's one of these people that would just stop if he felt something wasn't good for his health. And he had no questions, and he didn't regret it. He enjoyed it, understood it, was very tolerant. This brings up a funny story. Charles is dying of cancer, and Mary Paul and I are taking care of him. And Massachusetts, as you know, has a medical marijuana law and all that. And he's diagnosed. He's living in Massachusetts at the time when he's diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. And I said to him, "Charles, you really should get the certification, the card, to be able to use medical marijuana." That's talking about my own personal things with him, where we smoke grass or whatever together. And years ago, it was never a big thing. I mean, much bigger thing was, wine and all that type of stuff, because it was just better. And he said, no, I don't want anything to do with it. Well, at the end, almost at the end of his life, he then says to me, "Jay, I really think I want, I really need to change my mood. I want you to get some grass for me." I said, "But Charles, you haven't gone through the process of getting the card and all this. And so it's very hard to get and all that." So he says, "Well, go out in the street and buy some. Everyone else does." I said, "Charles, wait a second, so you want me to go out and, I'm an old guy now, right? Score some grass and stuff like that." So I said, "Oh my God." And he's very insistent. There's no discussion here. And so I talked to my wife, Mary Paul, and of course she's French. She has a green card. Of course, she's terrified of being deported at any moment. All right. I mean, you can't imagine what we went through legally. We were married in France, all kinds. So she's terrified of this. And so I tell her, she says, oh my God, Jay, you can't go out and buy marijuana in the street. What if you get caught and all this other stuff? And I said, okay. I said, but you know, I seem to remember that years ago when, you know, in the day, you could take oregano, and oregano had a kind of taste or whatever, pretty close. So what I'm going to do is, Charles wanted me to make him marijuana cookies. Okay. And so I said, what I'm going to do is I'll substitute oregano. And then we had a nurse, a young woman, and I know, you know, she occasionally took a toke and this and that. I said, oh my God, what if she decides she's going to eat them? Some of them too, with Charles. And Charles set up a hierarchy, believe me. Attractive young women. So it went, in this case, it went April, who was his nurse, who he didn't want at all, then Mary Paul, and then the squirrel outside his window, and then me. Okay. That's how the hierarchy went with Charles at that point. So I said, okay, we got to let April in on the ruse here, that really, you know, it was a placebo. We figured we'll do the placebo effect with Charles. So sure enough, we're really busy at the bistro at this point. Really, I mean, and Charles says, well, where are my cookies? I said, Charles, you know, come on. I literally didn't have time to bake the damn cookies. And he's really upset about it. So I figure, okay, so I, you know, put them together and I make them with, rather than butter, I use duck fat. I mean, we're real French bistro, okay? So they're rich, they're good, okay? And, all right, so I put the oregano in and all that. And so I tell April, his nurse and all that. So the cookies are there and he has special things. He has special things that he wants to eat. And he has, and I said, only one. Okay. Well, he not only eats one, he not only eats two, but he eats three of them. And he says to April, oh, he says, I'm feeling really great. I'm feeling wonderful. This is really good. And so April leaves, he comes back and he's dead. Yeah, yeah. So that's the story of Charles and his marijuana stocks. That's a true story. So, well, thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.